This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Will America's President Donald Trump be able to tamp down the trend of increasing violence in American cities? Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques is looking at an overview of this important trend, something the Trumpet staff has been watching from our earliest editions over 20 years ago, and he's going to put it in the context of biblical prophecy for us. This probably won't come as a shock to you, but American university students are quite ignorant of American history. But they're not just ignorant. They actually view the history of the nation in which they've grown up as being wicked, corrupt, and racist. They've actually come to think of America as uniquely evil. They think much more favorably on other nations, including socialist and communist nations. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau about this dangerous trend. If you wanted to read a story about a great flood that covered the whole earth, wiping out all the people except a small group that survived in a boat along with a bunch of animals, you could read the early chapters of the book of Genesis in the Bible, or you could read the Epic of Gilgamesh that comes from the ancient city of Sumeria, or you could read the Babylonian Ark Tablet, or the Greek myth of Deucalion, or a number of other stories and legends and historical accounts from countries all over the planet. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Chris Eames about just how universal the story of the flood really is. And I'll conclude the program with a thought I had after going 1 month without a drop of coffee. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. President Donald Trump campaigned as the law and order president. He drew attention to the rise in violent crime in America's cities and said he would reverse that trend. It seems like there are actually people who are intent on preventing him from succeeding there, who are advocating greater lawlessness. So there's a bit of a head-to-head coming about in that front. At thetrumpet.com, we're about to launch a reboot of our website, and one feature we're going to have on the new site is highlighting trends that we are watching around the world and in our society today, trying to put what we see today in context and why we're watching it, explaining what we've said about it in the past, what the Bible prophesies about it. And one of those trends is the increase in violence and racial tension in America. Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques is working on an article explaining why we watch this trend. He's here in the studio to talk about it. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So bring us up to speed with what's going on here. Violence and racial tension in America, why is this something that we watch?
Well, it's one of the main reasons we've started to watch this more closely is because it does seem to be increasing pretty quickly in the last few years. We've seen in 2014, there were riots there in Ferguson, Missouri. Then the next year, riots broke out in Baltimore, Maryland, and then again in Ferguson. Then in 2016, there were Milwaukee riots and also some riots in Charlotte, in my home state there. And then just the murder rate as a whole in the United States is suddenly, after many years of decline, it's now rising faster than any time in the past 45 years. There's data from the FBI that shows that, let me see, in 2015, there were 15,696 murders. And that means that the nationwide homicide count rose by 10.8% over the year before that. And that was the biggest year-to-year percentage jump since 1971. So it's a pretty remarkable increase there. And we won't have the national data for 2016 until later on this year, around September. But The Economist has done some preliminary analysis of 50 of America's most violent cities for 2016. So we have kind of an early peek into a lot of the data for those cities. And in 34 of them, homicide rates rose considerably. So it really looks like for 2 years running, there's been an increase in pretty much all the major cities. And a lot of this is racially related or gang related in some cases. And it's a trend that warrants close scrutiny, because this really could lead to, you know, it's the type of thing that can quickly spread like wildfire to other cities and even into rural areas as well. America, you know, we possess unrivaled military might. We have amazing geography, two oceans on each side and a friendly nation to the north. All of those things would make it difficult for an outside power to invade us. But what if we were first brought to our knees by internal violence? You know, what if first there was broad scale civil war that just deteriorated our society? That would make the nation vulnerable to foreign attack. And so that's really at the heart of why we watch these kinds of things so closely.
Which it sounds like alarmism, but there's actually biblically prophetic passages that inform that that concern over that. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. But we do try to, at thetrumpet.com, go beyond just explaining what's happening. We try to get to the causes. What are some of the causes that you see for this spike in violence and rioting?
Well, really at the heart of it would be the breakdown of family. When you have weaker families, you have children that grow up without a father figure. That's happening more and more, especially in inner city communities. And the result of families like that, it's just children that very often are more prone to violence. And so that's a huge factor. As families become weaker, violence becomes more prevalent. And we've been able to contain a lot of those criminal elements since, I believe going back 30 years, our prison populations have quintupled, mm-hmm. something like that. So the majority of offenders are incarcerated, which keeps the crime rate from spiking as much as you would think. But even with those bloated prison systems, we still have crimes just ticking upward once again in some pretty dramatic ways. And that gets back to the breakdown of families. But we also have what's called the Ferguson effect. We've talked about that on the show before, but when there have been minorities involved in rioting against what they call police brutality and things like that, the leadership in the U.S. has very often called for restraint from law enforcement. They've said, you know, instead of squelching this violence, let's give them space to express their free speech and things like that. And of course, police
brutality, which somehow has come to include smashing storefront windows. And
yes.
So
yeah, exactly. If once you tell your law enforcement, just let this happen, let this looting and rioting and smashing of storefront windows, just let it happen. We don't want to be too heavy handed here. That sort of thing is demoralizing to law enforcement. We also saw after the Freddie Gray death. He was a young black man that died in police custody there in Baltimore. And almost immediately after that, the six police officers who were basically present for that situation, they were all indicted on charges of manslaughter and murder, things like that. Those charges were later dropped for all six of them. But that kind of decision by the upper echelons of leadership to say, well, we kind of need to appease the people. We need to, you know, appease the mob here. Let's go ahead and indict these officers. That sort of thing is very demoralizing to police forces, and it makes others, and we've seen this nationally, police have become reluctant to use force in many situations at all, because they don't want to be the guy on the, you know, who's at the forefront of the next big scandal, mm-hmm. over police brutality. And, you know, of course there is no excuse for police brutality, but in a lot of these cases, there was not actually police brutality. It was only the accusation of that. And then the media seems to get on board. Anyway, it all ends up, just sort of handcuffing law enforcement officers. And that leads to more violence.
So you have gone back and tracked what the Trumpet has said about this from the beginning. Is that right? Gerald Fleury, I know when it was the Los Angeles riots back in 1992, I believe, where he talked about this, and he started to draw attention, the attention of Trumpet readers to some of these basic prophecies. And it's pretty remarkable here, 25 years later, to see just how prescient some of those statements were that he made back at that time. It's become more and more relevant as we've seen this issue continue to crop up with increasing frequency, and it seems especially under the Obama presidency that it became a much more present crisis in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. Mr. Fleury, the editor-in-chief of the Trumpet, has been forecasting about this for over 20 years now, just saying violence in our cities and racial tensions, these things are going to get worse and worse, and they're going to play a major role in unraveling the fabric of our society. And in the time since he first began to call attention to that, we have seen so many really significant flare-ups in that kind of violence. So it was definitely prescient. And now you could see, especially under President Obama, he was among those voices that called for the kind of restraint among law enforcement that only exacerbated this trend. And it only kind of fueled the flames of these fires. I think that if politicians knew the type of fire they were playing with this kind of thing, they would be very quick to do everything they could to, make sure that these flare-ups don't happen, that they're not encouraged, that the media doesn't kind of be a cheerleader on the sidelines, just cheering this on. But you get the feeling that they don't realize the potential that this has to be a national explosion. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, it's not really squelched.
And it seems like there have been some cases where there's enough of a seed of truth that it puts doubts in the minds of many people. There's a lot of statements about individuals who they experience a certain amount of what they consider unfair racial profiling at the hands of police and so on. And so that once you begin to nurture that sense of grievance, then it does take on a much more widespread flavor to it. There are a lot more people who feel like they see evidence of this in wherever they look, and you begin to foment the ingredients for something that really could be quite explosive. And when you compare that with, as Gerald Fleury has done, the prophecies that show violence, particularly within the cities and the urban centers in the United States, you really do see how damaging and destructive this can be.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Mr. Fleury has called particular attention to Isaiah chapter 1, verse 7, which is about modern day America and the UK to a degree. But this verse says, "Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devoured in your presence, and it is desolate as overthrown by strangers." So that's describing, we see some of the early fulfillment of that with these flare-ups in Baltimore and Ferguson and elsewhere. But most of that still remains to be fulfilled. But it's very, sobering to read the language of that and to know that that's what modern day America will soon become.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at the big picture here, obviously if you really do have to work to wrap your head around just how severe the descriptions within biblical prophecy are of how bad conditions are going to get in the cities. But at the same time, it's not all about death and destruction. There is a bigger picture that these prophecies give us that, that help inform, as we're watching this trend, how we can look at this and not just, there is hope in the prophecies as well.
There's so much hope in these prophecies. It's very sobering in the short term. If you look just to, the passage that I read there, Isaiah 1:7, for example, that looks bleak. It looks dark. It's going to be the kind of destruction that this world has never seen. It'll eventually contribute to this worldwide conflict. But these same passages, these same prophecies, if you read the context, if you keep on reading in Isaiah and elsewhere, you see that this is connected to good news too. In fact, the best news that you could really hear. And basically it's, God promises that he will protect any individual, whether they're black or white or any other race. He'll protect Americans or British, any other nationality. any individual who repents and turns to him. And the promise even goes beyond just physical protection in the short term. This is a hope-saturated plan that includes offering eternal life to every person who has ever lived. So these passages are, you know, sometimes it may be easy to get caught up just in the short-term part of it, which seems pretty daunting and pretty dark, but I would just encourage people to keep reading, you know, get the whole picture there, and you'll see that really all of this is tied to the greatest hope you could imagine.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about violence in America and where this is leading. He's working on an article that gives an overview of this subject. It's one of several articles you'll be able to find on thetrumpet.com. We're about to launch a reboot of that website, and I'd encourage you to look for the trends portion of the website. This is one of those trends that the Trumpet staff has been watching for quite some years, and this article will explain why it's so important to keep your eyes on. But we look forward to reading that, Jeremiah, and we appreciate you coming in and talking about it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
How well do you know American history? If you're an American, chances are pretty good that the younger you are, the less you know about it. I graduated high school in 1990, and I have to say I was embarrassingly ignorant of quite a lot of it. I've been taking various weapons of education to that ignorance in recent years. It's been a great study. It's really helped me to just come to love what is unique about this country and give me a lot of respect for those who founded it. But new information is coming out that shows young people today are not only ignorant about American history, but they're hostile about American history. Trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau has written an article about this. Hello, Abraham.
Hello.
Good to have you here. You're talking about this information that came from a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin, who did a survey on this, and maybe you could just share his findings with us.
Sure. James Pesta, he's an associate professor of English at the University of Wisconsin. He's been, for the past 10 years, doing these surveys about American history and how students feel about Western institutions and Western ways of life, like capitalism. And he's some pretty astounding findings. And what's really nice is it's 10 years of data. It's not just the sample of today. These are trends that have been happening over the last 10 years. And the first one that's pointed out is in one survey, he asked students to define capitalism and then socialism. And 7 out of 10 students defined capitalism by using the words greedy, selfish, and unfair. And then 83% of students define socialism by using the words such as fairness and equality. So 83% of all those students thought that socialism was much more positive, much more beneficial than capitalism in the very system in which they live and operate in. And so that in itself is a pretty revealing statement in how they think about economics, who they will vote for when it comes to things like healthcare and different kind of public programs.
Right. We've seen the results of this in the recent election, especially in the support for Bernie Sanders and for Hillary Clinton, who had to co-opt a lot of his policies in order to lay claim to his segment of the electorate. But capitalism versus socialism, maybe it's interesting to think about people being so bent out of shape over the word capitalism, but this system has enabled America to become, or at least certainly contributed to, the greatest wealth of any nation in history. And I think that the word capitalism actually comes from socialists as kind of an epithet against the system, but really it's about free markets. It's about freedom of economy.
Yeah, when you look at this historically, at the examples of capitalism and socialism, how they operate inside of a state, And now both are flawed. Both are subject to improvement. You can point out plenty of negative things about capitalism too, as many people, historians do. But if you look on the whole, on the greatest scale possible, capitalism is responsible for the two greatest societies ever in human history that have given us the most wealth, prosperity, security, and that is Great Britain, their empire, and the Commonwealth, and then the United States. And especially since the 1800s, almost every single country in the world has sought to adopt an American-type capitalism because it works, and it has pitfalls with it. But when you compare it to the actual facts of what happens when you implement socialism, it can provide some benefits for the poor and people who need things and that sort of thing. But on the whole, though, it leads to debt, terrible mismanagement of finances, even to the rise of dictatorships. And what we're seeing in Venezuela and other Latin American countries, it are the long-term effects of socialism. Even Britain today is suffering from that, from many years of being a welfare state.
Right. That's a great point. The fact that the more you rely on the government in order to distribute wealth across society, the more power the government has, and the easier it is for the government to take that power and misuse it. You make the point in this article about the fact that it has given rise to totalitarian regimes across the world and throughout history. And that's a history that is being overlooked and ignored or airbrushed over within these universities that are putting these ideas in the heads of the students.
Yeah, exactly. And the attitude towards capitalism stems from that they don't understand much about how this nation was established, but from about the founding fathers. And there's some great information here from PESA, from his surveys, about how they view the Constitution and the founding fathers. And in one, more students identified Andrew Jackson as a slaveholder than as a U.S. president. They stated, this is quoting the students, they say that slavery began in the United States and was almost exclusively an American phenomenon. And that's such a terrible error. It shouldn't even need to be pointed out upon, because slavery is as old as the human race, unfortunately, and has been around. It still is around today. But it was the American and the British peoples who spearheaded the abolition movement to get rid of slavery. And so it is just a terrible thing when students can look in the past and they know these great men, such as Andrew Jackson, other U.S. presidents, founding fathers, as slaveholders, rather than recognizing the achievements of how they founded this nation.
Right. When you look at the history of slave ownership in the United States, there are definitely some embarrassing things there and some ugly things there. But as you said, to view it as basically a uniquely American institution really overlooks the overarching picture of slavery in America. That is the fact that we got rid of it, and it was probably the most difficult thing that America had to do in its history, but it was a success story overall. Even though there are embarrassing chapters in that history, you have to just take pride in the fact that we actually conquered that.
Yeah, it should be a subject of pride and motivation for what we can do in the future, rather than a source of hate and spiteful attitudes. And there's this great quote from the article by Marion Tuppy about PESTA. And this is talking about the attitude, where a lot of students have these attitudes towards capitalism, socialism, the founding fathers, but they actually don't know that much about them, in which to make these opinions. And she writes, as PESTA explained to me, in recent years, he had noticed a shift in the students' responses to his questions. Before the new millennium, the youngsters were historically ignorant but not politicized. Their ignorance, PESTA said, was accompanied by a basic humility about what they did not know. More recently, however, he noted a sense of moral superiority in not knowing anything about our racist and sexist history and our biased institutions. So this professor has noticed just a change in attitude as well, where, everyone's ignorant about certain things, and that's why people go to school to learn about things. So there's nothing wrong with being ignorant, but it's that attitude where they've already made these huge moral judgments against these massive figures of history, against the basic principles of this nation, in which they're going to frame their whole life. They make all those judgments before they even know anything about mm-hmm. those men, about the Constitution, about how the American economy and the rule of law has given them all these freedoms. And so there's just this this spiteful attitude, a hateful attitude towards our sexist, racist history as a whole. And even, as he said, they used words such as wicked and corrupt to describe the founding fathers mm-hmm. as well in the same surveys. So you can see how these students, they learn these attitudes from somewhere. And that's the most disturbing thing about all of this, I think.
Yeah, there was the story that came out recently about the University of Virginia students demanding that the school stop quoting its founder, who happened to be Thomas Jefferson, the one who penned the Declaration of Independence and wrote in it the fact that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And even though the founders did not live up to that ideal at the beginning, it was the language that Jefferson wrote into the Declaration of Independence that enabled Lincoln to do what he did, and it was the effort to aspire to that ideal that was enshrined in its founding document that enabled the abolition of slavery. And even though Jefferson did, I mean, you could, if you look at the history of American slave ownership, it is complicated, and probably Jefferson reflects a lot of that ambiguity or that complication, because he was a slave owner, but he did feel like it was wrong. And he actually said just before he died that the U.S. was founded on the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. He was an outspoken advocate against it, even though he failed to live up to that ideal personally. But it's a tragedy for these for the young people and those teachers who are indoctrinating them with these ideas to just dismiss them out of hand with this sense of moral superiority, as if they have the right to do that.
Right. Yeah, and it really is a testament to the small world in which they live. Like, if you don't accept or are not willing to learn about things, you do live in a smaller world than others, because you just don't have a full knowledge of a full picture of what's going on. And so, especially with the Constitution and the Founding Fathers, when you read their letters and everything on that process and how they were founding the nation, they really want to make the Constitution the sum of wisdom from all the greatest civilizations, Rome, Greece, and Great Britain, all the great constitutions, and make it the best possible, because one man alone cannot judge a nation, cannot rule within himself, because we live so short a time on earth and we have such a limited view of everything that we can't possibly make these huge decisions accurately within ourselves. And so by giving this framework of the Constitution and everything with it, allows them to draw off the wisdom of history and of all these other great nations who have come and gone. And so when these students dismiss the wisdom of the ages in the Constitution and other American examples, they're really shortchanging themselves on character development and on what they can really contribute in their lives, because they're just making these decisions in their own selves rather than expanding that and being able to make a really big difference. And I think that's the great tragedy in this, especially with those teachers from the elementary school level to the high school level to the university. It's pretty widespread, who are really indoctrinating them against the founding fathers, against the Constitution, is that you're really not helping the next generation become what they really can be. You're shortchanging their potential, I think.
It seems like the study of history, when it's done the right way, it does instill within you a sense of humility, and what you or what your generation is able to accomplish, and humility in the right sense, that you, it seems like the more you cut yourself off from that history, the more willing you are to fly off onto some adventurism of something that has been tried and failed before. And you don't recognize the potential for failure. You don't see just how dangerous something is because you haven't seen those the precedents that have already been established. And it seems like you really do. I mean, all of these statements that this University of Wisconsin professor made based on his survey of these students, you see it reflected in the politics of the nation. I mean, it seems to me like the more that Americans understand about their history, the more fundamentally conservative they will become, because you're trying to conserve and preserve what it is that has made this nation special. The more you cut yourself off from that, then the more willing you are to try whatever some politician promises for that day.
Right. Yeah. And that's what's really interesting, is that we're seeing the fruits of this education with the rioters and with people voting for socialist and even communistic platforms, and people voting in leaders who are perhaps undesirable, as we've seen a lot in maybe the last 10 years. So we have definite fruits from this educational system, and it's tearing this nation apart, because if the young people are the leaders of tomorrow, then maybe a lot of people don't have hope in what the future portends. Because if someone like President Barack Obama, who is very liberal, can become president today, who are going to be our leaders in the future if this trend continues? And that's a really disturbing thing to ponder.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau about ignorant, angry Americans. He's written an article on the subject called The Crisis of Angry Ignorance. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. It's a pleasure to talk with you, Abraham.
Thanks for having me on the show.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The flood is one of the most famous accounts in the Bible. Every kid has heard the story. It's been the source of books and movies. It's inspired men to go on expeditions to find Noah's Ark. But there are obviously plenty of people who say it's just a fable. It's a myth. It never happened. What's interesting, though, and you might not have realized this, is that the story of the flood is not limited to the Bible. All over the world, people of various cultures have recorded history of this catastrophic flood. And that's very interesting, because the Bible's account says it occurred over the whole planet. So it makes sense that all the cultures that sprang from the survivors would have their recollections of that event. Trumpet writer Chris Eames has written an article about just how universal the story of the flood is. We have him via Skype from England. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
So let's start by talking about probably the most famous extra-biblical account of the flood. That's the Epic of Gilgamesh. Where does this come from? What similarities does it have with the Bible's description?
Okay, well, this Epic of Gilgamesh is an ancient account from the city of Sumer, and the Sumer area is actually the first known established civilization in the Mesopotamian area. And so you'd expect from this area, where general area where Noah and that story comes from, we should find a parallel account in this Epic of Gilgamesh here. And the most complete tablets, ancient tablets, documenting this epic, the story of Gilgamesh, date to around 650 BC. But these are known to be copies from more ancient tablets dating to 2000 BC. So that's 4,000 years old. And even these tablets are believed to be dating, to be material from even older sources, which actually puts the original material right around the time of the flood. When just after the flood, when this must have happened. So this Epic of Gilgamesh basically describes the story of a Noah-like figure who's called Utnapishtim. Probably butchered that name. And according to the epic, this Utnapishtim built a boat within which he and his relatives and all species of living animals survived a flood that destroyed all of mankind. And like the biblical account, the Gilgamesh epic states that the reason for the flood was human wickedness. It describes a large boat coming to rest on a mountaintop after the flood. Both accounts describe birds being released once the boat has landed in order to test whether the waters have receded to see if there's dry land. And actually, on this point of the birds, the Epic of Gilgamesh describes the use of the dove and raven species, exactly the same species that the Bible describes was used to test about the land. Both accounts, the Gilgamesh and Bible accounts, record that sacrifices were offered after the flood. And both records say that the men, Noah, Utnapishtim, in this case for Gilgamesh, were afterward blessed. So you can see some really close links between those stories. They're really probably the most famous extra-biblical story from Gilgamesh.
Right. You also have the Babylonian Ark tablet. Tell us about this.
That's right. This one's slightly younger, as in 1900 to 1700 BC, so still nearly 4,000 years old, this one. This describes a Noah-like figure, this time called Atrahasis. And this Atrahasis is told to build a boat for himself and the animals to survive an imminent flood. Now, the really unique thing about this Babylonian Ark tablet is that the animals that boarded this boat did so two by two. That's what this tablet reads. It literally reads, they boarded the boat two by two. And that's just perfect match-up language with how the Bible describes it. Genesis 7, verse 2, verses 8 to 9, it talks about the animals entering the ark in pairs. So a really interesting link there. The ark tablet does differ from the biblical account in the fact that this ark is perfectly round in shape. But again, there are those similarities that you just can't deny linking the Babylonian Ark tablet to the biblical account. And of course, Moses wrote that biblical account of the flood a little bit later, a couple of hundred years or so later than the Ark tablet.
Right. Well, that's an interesting point. The fact that the account that the Bible has actually came some several generations after the events
Right.
themselves. But so those who say, look at the similarities among these different accounts, and we'll discuss some more in a bit, do they, I mean, it seems like a pretty cut and dried, a simple explanation that it happened and these different people recorded their versions of it. And so that's tends to give a lot of veracity to the biblical account rather than just dismissing it out of hand to say, well, it makes sense that all of these different cultures would have their versions of it. But is there an alternative explanation that that gives the critic or the skeptic an out?
Well, one of the areas that skeptics take from this is that this all happened, all of these records that we've just talked about here happened in the Mesopotamian area, the biblical record, the Gilgamesh epic, the Ark tablet. And so one out that they have, so to speak, about this is maybe it was a regional flood. Maybe this is just something that happened over the wider Levant Mesopotamian area. And
so they don't dispute the fact that it happened. It's just a matter of the scope of it.
Well, there would be some, I would say, that do dispute the fact that it happened. Again, there isn't really any basis for why they would necessarily do that. But yeah, on the whole, they would point to it being a more localized flood rather than a globe-girdling flood, as these accounts themselves detail.
All right. Well, let's cast our net a little bit wider then. If they would say, well, this is just more right in that area of Mesopotamia, but other cultures further afield also have their versions of this as well. Maybe you could share a few of those.
Right. And this is what we need to take into account in looking at this global idea of this flood that happened. And of course, if we look at the biblical account, it must have been a global flood that's described. And so we can look further afield and find exactly these flood accounts. The next one I talk about in my article is the Greek myth of Deucalion. That's looking a little further afield, but just to briefly run down this myth. It states that after human beings were created, they disobeyed the gods. It was decided they should be destroyed. The righteous Deucalion and his wife were spared in an ark from the flood that destroyed mankind. The ark landed on a mountain, and after surviving the flood, Deucalion offered sacrifices. Now we look even further afield. The ancient Chinese themselves told many myths about floods, some describing the waters as reaching heaven. Again, language very similar to the Bible. In some of these legends, the main character is a female named Nua, similar name to Noah for the linguists out there. And this Nua repopulates the earth after the flood and repairs the broken heavens. Now, an imagery very similar to the rainbow of Genesis, Nua patches the damaged sky by smelting stones of five different colors together. Hmm. So you can see similarities there.
Right, with the Bible describing the rainbow and God actually setting the rainbow in the heavens as a sign of his covenant that he wouldn't flood the earth again.
Right. So so you've got these links between certain details there, which are quite interesting. And you can move further afield into the Hindu tale of Manu, who is warned about a flood and builds a boat to contain the seeds of life to repopulate the earth. You can read of Irish Welsh flood myths. There's the Finnish flood myths. There's the Norse blood deluge myths. In typical Scandinavian fashion and gore, they go for the blood deluge myths. And throughout Africa, there's many oral traditions about a massive flood that happened. You've got Pacific flood myths. Ancient American flood myths, so that's from the Native Americans, that's from the South and Latin Americans, all across the world. You've got this global idea of a massive flood that occurred way back in our connected ancestry there.
So there is an individual, Dr. John Morris, who has compiled information from over 200 accounts of the flood from cultures all over the world. Tell us about some of his findings.
Sure. This John Morris has collected these 200 accounts reported from missionaries, anthropologists, ethnologists, and he's taken these accounts and looked at, okay, what percentage of certain facts about these accounts relate? What are similar? What are the similarities here? Mm-hmm. And he breaks it down into quite a good percentage table. And so, reading a couple of these percentages, he looks at the fact, was the flood global? 95% of these 200 accounts discuss a flood being global. Was survival due to a boat? That was similar in 70% of the accounts. Is there a favored family? That was 88% of the accounts hold a favored family as surviving this flood. Were animals saved? 67%. Did they land on a mountain? 57%. And even was a rainbow mentioned? That's in 7% of these stories. So maybe it doesn't sound like much, but when you multiply that by two, there's 200 accounts here. So that's 14 of them in which some sort of a rainbow was mentioned in relation to this flood account. Were specifically eight persons mentioned, eight persons saved? That's 9% of the accounts reference eight persons being saved. So he does quite a good job in collating these accounts and putting them together in a percentage format. Now there's a few more statistics from him, so you'll have to go to the article, The Great Flood, just a Bible story that's on thetrumpet.com, and read those for yourself. But it's amazing to see the link between these different cultures and the similar flood story.
Yeah, very interesting. I appreciate you bringing that to us, Chris. We've been talking with trumpet writer Chris Eames about stories from all over the world about the Great Flood and how many similarities there are with the Bible's account, how that gives the Bible a bit more cachet and veracity when you look at that account. It's not the only place that you can find that flood account by any means. But as Chris mentioned, he's written this article, The Great Flood, Just a Bible Story. It's got a lot more information about the similarities between these over 200 accounts from cultures all over the world. You can find that article on thetrumpet.com or where it originally appeared, watchjerusalem.com. Chris is writing regularly for that website, and we'd encourage you to go check that out as well. So thank you very much, Chris. We appreciate you talking to us about this.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
Recently, I decided to go 1 month with no coffee, just to make sure I could. I didn't think it would be hard. I don't drink a lot of coffee, but I do enjoy it. I have one cup in the morning as I do Bible study, literally one cup, not a cauldron-sized mug that can fit a gallon of Joe. The smell, the taste, the warmth, it's a wonderful treat, but I indulge in moderation. During that month, however, I was dumbfounded at how much I thought about coffee. Before dropping off to sleep at night, I would have a pang of regret thinking of the beverageless study awaiting in the morning. I would pass Coffee Creek Road just a few miles from our house and think, that sounds delicious. I don't believe coffee is a sin, although it could be, but this experience did get me thinking about how powerful sin can be. In Romans 6 and verse 14, the Apostle Paul made this profound statement: sin shall not have dominion over you. Sin is an extensive, spreading, multiplying, malignant cancer in our world. It pours from the mind of Satan, from the minds of others, from our very own thoughts. This insidious evil power dominates everything, everywhere, every day, and you have the duty and the mission to stand against it. You're called not just to battle, but to a lifelong war against sin. In your mind, you must not only smash the chains of sin, but escape its entire dominion. If you cut a sin from your life, and yet you still find yourself yearning for it, that sin still has a type of dominion over you. You've denied yourself from gratifying that wrong desire, but you still have to fight off that yearning to see, hear, think, or do something wrong. It's to be expected that a lifelong habit will take time to die off, but that yearning is a type of dominion. It's something that must be healed in your mind, whether it takes days or years. Verse 12 says, "Let not sin therefore reign in your mortal body, that you should obey it in the lusts thereof." Herbert W. Armstrong talked about this issue in the March 1979 Good News. He said this: "Listen, my children, in the living Christ, do you really want to smoke, want to have birthday parties, want to go along with this world in its ways? Is that what you really want to do? Do you have to use self-resistance, self-discipline, and willpower to prevent going along in this world's ways?" Now, I'm sure something like smoking holds little temptation for someone who's been in God's church for a long time, but there are maybe other areas in your life where the world's ways do hold some appeal, areas where you do have to exercise self-resistance and self-discipline and willpower to keep them in check. And again, there are areas where, like coffee, a moderate amount of itself is not a sin, but there is a principle worth contemplating here. Now, think about what Mr. Armstrong wrote in this article. He challenges us to compare our attitude about these things to God's attitude. He wrote, "Does God really want to sin, but because he has willpower of resistance, he uses willpower and does not allow himself to sin?" And this is his answer. "Can you realize that sin is absolutely abhorrent to God? God does not want to sin. He has no such desire. He hates sin. He's not tempted to sin. God loves and desires righteousness and holiness. That's what he loves, desires, and does." Well, that's God's attitude. How does it compare to yours and to mine? That pull we feel from worldly things is actually a measure of the world's hold on us, and in a sense of sin's dominion over us. Now, take a listen how Mr. Armstrong followed up. After asking if you have to exercise self-discipline to resist sin, he wrote, "If so, you have not yet been really conquered by the all-loving God. If so, you do not yet have the mind of Christ or his attitude or approach to problems or questions. If so, you'd better begin trembling at the word of God. Those are strong words. God doesn't want us hungering or thirsting for the world, having to exercise willpower to avoid giving in to those yearnings. He wants us hungering and thirsting for righteousness and holiness. That's what he says in Matthew 5 and verse 6. Mr. Armstrong said, you can't have both attitudes. You have one or the other. Which is it? Now, this might seem daunting. It feels hard enough to shake off the shackles of a persistent sin that you've been struggling with, let alone to fully conquer the temptation as well. But you do have help. Ask God to help you eliminate even the desire for sin. Plead with him to change your thinking and your desires to make them just like his own. Strive to become more and more like God to the point where sin has absolutely no dominion over you. Go to war every day like a resistance fighter who believes in his cause, and God will give you the power to overcome temptation, to conquer sins left and right, to experience a change in your life that is nothing short of revolutionary. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Jeremiah Jacques, Abraham Blondeau, and Chris Eames. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Marvin Phillips. The difference between try and triumph is just a little oomph. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.